Was it a fairly quiet landing at San Carlos, Alan, or did you have a reception committee waiting for you?
No, there was no reception committee, and we did have a quiet and safe landing transferring to San Carlos settlement. It was a fine day, and in fact they could have bombed us that day and attacked, but they didn't. And after that the weather deteriorated and the opportunity for air attack was much reduced for 3 or 4 days after that. When we landed, our first consideration was coping with the loads which we were carrying, because what we didn't have and take with us and carry simply wasn't available to the battalion, and the usefulness of a battalion is only as great as the munition it can carry and the food and so on that it has to sustain itself. There was very little helicopter help for us at this stage, so that men were overloaded with mortar bombs and heavy machine gun ammunition and ammunition for their small arms and food and so on, so that the weights carried by the men were simply stupendous. On top of that, because we heard so much about the inclement weather on the Falkland Islands, quite a few people had put far too much clothing on. And anyway, it seemed a good place to put the clothing, put it on rather than stow it away where there wasn't much room. And so that we were very overloaded and heavily clad, many of us, landing on a day which was really quite mild in comparison with further days that we had on the Falkland Islands, so that one or two people even overheated. In fact, my first casualty on arriving in the Falkland Islands was, believe it or not, one of heat exhaustion, which is another of the paradoxes of the situation one met. A chap who was, as it turned out, a little prone to this form of heat illness, who'd put far too much on in the way of thermal underwear and wetproof suits and so on, and had heated up underneath the weight of his equipment. He was carrying parts of a 0.5 Browning machine gun, and the poor chap collapsed, but we were able to revive him. At that stage he carried on. So, in fact, we landed in a hot, safe, and altogether different way to what we expected. And we marched from San Carlos settlement with all this weight on to the Verde Mountains, I think they were called, which was about the hills about 2 kilometres away from the jetty, where we were told to dig in a spread out fashion on the side of the hills which looked down towards the end of San Carlos water. Some parts of this territory were awfully wet, and digging down but a few feet through the peaty soil, you've got water running into the trenches that you're trying to dig, so it was impossible to dig deep trenches except in a few spots. And really all you could do was dig a little way down and then build up round the outside of the trench with turves of peat to make a protective wall. And what most soldiers did was to do this and put their ground sheets over the top of the peat wall, making a little protection from the wind and wet that was later to come. But it was a very damp and soggy place. And the first night wasn't too bad, but for the two other Carlos on the hills, it became progressively windier and wetter and colder. And the only enemy activity we had at that time were a few red air raid alerts without any action at all. So really quite a quiet time and a useful time to get acclimatised to what was to come.
And the three battalions were still together at that stage, were they?
Well, no, this is really where we split up. We stayed, we were together as a battalion at that stage, but other battalions were given different tasks in brigade, and the Welsh Guards, they moved off at this stage to try and walk from the San Carlos area, San Carlos Sound, to the Goose Green area, where they were required for their next phase of operation. But I believe, although I've got no personal knowledge, that they had to turn back from this because with the weights they were carrying, a long distance was simply not possible.
Yes.
They had all that they needed, I'm sure, but they it is a fact that if you travel far, you travel light, and if you travel heavy, you don't travel far. And they proved it that day. It was simply impossible with the soft ground and the wet and the loads they were carrying to go very far before they started getting slowed down with people being, being held back by their loads. So they turned around from that journey. And I think that is one of the silly things that happened in the story arose. Reporters who saw this, and I believe saw certain Welsh Guardsmen sit down under the weight of their loads, say, oh, well, they're not like the Marines, these Guardsmen. They will never be able to walk very far. And this was later given as a reason why the brigade didn't, as it were, in Marine terms, yomp from San Carlos to Port Stanley. The guards don't do that. They do what the rest of the infantry and the paras do. They tab, which is a long march under load. And I don't think there was much difference between them, except that the amount of material which the guards were given to carry was so much greater. And if the Marines had had the same weights, the same thing would have happened to them. This is how I feel about the situation. I don't think the two sorts of soldier were awfully different. But where I do think there was a difference was the acclimatisation to the cold and wet that the Marines had experienced on their previous training, which we hadn't had. Yes. And we must give them best on. This was invaluable. The Marines were tailor-made, I think, to the situation which faced them.
Yes, I mean, they've been up to Norway really very recently.
Absolutely, yes. And they had detected all the imperfections in their kit and the amount of kit that they could manage under such conditions. And we were learning rapidly, it's true, but we were still in the learning phase, and we had one or two lessons to learn, which they already knew about. But of course, there was no opportunity for them to communicate their expertise to us because they'd already set out, and so we were very much finding things out for ourselves.
What did your medical staff consist of, in fact, or what is a battalion medical staff made up of?
My medical staff consisted of myself and a car sergeant in the Scots Guards who'd spent many years working with the regimental aid post, and a sergeant in Scots Guards, also a regimental medical assistant, a lance sergeant, and between various times five or six junior NCOs and guardsmen, who formed the nucleus of the first aid and medical support for the battalion.
So although they were medically trained, they weren't in fact members of the RAMC?
No. The RAMC only figured insofar as I was there. And also, from the moment we landed in San Carlos, we were reinforced medically by D section of 16 Field Ambulance under the command of Major Ken Miller. And his men, in fact, were RAMC, all except one, I believe, and they were our extra medical backup, and they remained with us in one way or another throughout the rest of the war and in the reorganisation and resettlement period afterwards.
Yes, and at various stages, of course, there was surgical support at both San Carlos and later at Fitzroy and Bluffcote.
Yes, fortunately, we had very little in the way of medical events. While we were 3 days and nights on the hills near San Carlos in the wet, I remember one casualty had to be evacuated. He was a man suspected of having appendicitis and was exposed as well. And we attracted a helicopter that was sent to pick him up, to take him to Ajax Bay, where the medical facility then was. By a device I'd not seen used before, called a firefly, which is like a little torch with a sharp winking light, which is very easily seen by helicopters. And a light helicopter was safely guided in. He was picked up at night and taken to Ajax, and he was the only casualty we had evacuated at that time, which is fortunate because we didn't have any of our regimental aid post equipment or our tent, and we were operating from the trenches that we dug and lived in ourselves.
Yes. I think after this short respite on land, you went to sea again, didn't you?
Yes, but on rather different circumstances to our previous journey in luxury. This turned out to be quite the opposite. I must just say here, my last night in San Carlos was very wet and windy, and I think probably through a certain amount of inexperience and ill luck, I went to sleep, or attempted to go to sleep, in clothing which was getting wet. And sleep became difficult to get at first. And then I realized that there was something wrong, radically wrong. And then it dawned on me that, in fact, I was suffering from cold illness myself. I was getting hypothermic. I started to get rather interesting psychedelic dreams, a thing I never get. And I took this to be a warning sign that I was attempting to go to sleep while too cold. And although the night was beginning to freeze at this stage, I was sensible enough to get out of my sleeping bag and use a complete change of thermal underwear clothing, which I had wrapped in a little polythene bag in my Bergen, which is a waterproof kit bag, and have a complete change of clothing, and then run up and down on the peat outside my trench and get warm again. And I managed to get comfortable again at the expense of having any sleep that night. The cold prevented me getting any sleep. And I think, for the lesson I learned from this, that in any cold or wet conditions where they're prolonged and you don't have a chance to dry out, and you've got to face the fact that there's not going to be any cover or shelter from the wind and wet, you've got to have a waterproof bag or Bergen that you carry on your back, and in that there've got to be lots of subsidiary small bags, each containing a perfect, complete change of clothing, so that if you do get wet, you can change into dry things. Because eventually, in the very humid atmosphere you get in the Falkland Islands, however much care you take, damp and then wet will gradually penetrate even to waterproof clothing bags. Unless you have everything individually wrapped in polythene, light polythene, it will get wet and it will let you down when you most need it. So that was a very important lesson that we learned at that time.
And if this sort of thing had happened to, as I'm sure it did, to members of the battalion, they were presumably warned about this.
Well, they were very hardy fellows, let me say that. They impressed me very much with their resilience, and whatever I say about illnesses and injuries and sicknesses they had, it occurs to me at this stage to praise their resilience and manliness when faced with adversity, illness and wounding. I was so impressed. I have the deepest respect for these men because of their resilience. But the reason why I mentioned this wet episode of my own was only that I felt, when I was trying to get warm that night, this must be the worst night of my life. I felt really very miserable then. Although pleased that I managed to overcome the problem, this gave some cause of satisfaction. But I was quite wrong about it being the worst night of my life. The worst night of my life was to be the next night, and I'll tell you about that now.
Yes.
When we left when we left San Carlos, where we landed on the 2nd of June, we were there for 3 nights. And on the fourth day, as it were, we marched from the Verde Mountains down back to San Carlos settlement, where we got on the same jetty that we'd landed at, embarked upon landing craft, and moved out to HMS Intrepid, which is a sister ship of HMS Fearless. And this is has accommodation for a battalion of men and their equipment, and it was absolutely super to get on board HMS Intrepid, because it was so terribly hot inside. Immediately all one's wet evaporated from one's clothes. It was possible to dry out and get one's kit in a reasonable order, and its great value was that the few precious hours we spent on HMS Intrepid was really giving people a further respite for future operations by giving them, as it were, a second chance, because they'd learnt a lot of the lessons that they hadn't learnt up to then about keeping dry, keeping their kit in good order. And they were all given a second chance. They had a few hours to dry out again, repack, clean up, ready for the next phase. And the plan was to sail from San Carlos Sound by night round the west coast of East Falkland Island, down Falkland Sound in other words, and round the south coast and up in an adventurous right hook movement round the enemy's position, to, as it were, approach Stanley from the south and west, as opposed to the approaches being made from the north and east, north and west, by the Marine Brigade. And we were the spearhead of this hook movement. And the idea was to drop us off in the area of Lively Island, because although we could have gone in further in HMS Intrepid, it was considered unsafe because the threat from Exocet attack from Stanley was so great. Once you got round the round Lively Island, then you were in imminent danger of being attacked by Exocet missiles. So unfortunately, she had to set us down well short of our objective, which was Bluff Cove, where we were making for, which we knew to be in lightly held by the 2nd Battalion Parachute Regiment, and they were waiting to be relieved by us because they were unable to certainly hold the position for any length of time owing to their previous casualties and exertions.
Because they'd been at Goose Green.
They indeed had gone through Goose Green, their magnificent victory there, and the vanguard of them had reached as far as Bluff Cove and Fitzroy. And we were going to take over from then at Bluff Cove, as it turned out, and they then regrouped in Fitzroy before going on to other things later. So there it was, we were briefed by, shall we say, a very laconic amphibious operations officer from the Royal Marines, who, when I heard his briefing, I gave myself very little hope of surviving the night. Because I could see what was coming. We were going to be put down in open boats at night, well away from shore, and had to negotiate round a lot of little small islands and rocks and headlands off the West Fork, off the East Falkland Island, on our way to Bluff Cove. And this was projected to take a minimum of 4 hours. As it turned out, it took 7 hours, or just over. And the journey was made at night in open boats, which were packed with men and their equipment. And it was just possible to get the whole battalion and its equipment into 4 of these landing ships that Intrepid carried within her inner harbour, which is inside the ship. But since we were carrying so much equipment and food and ammunition, we were pretty heavily loaded, and I'm sure the ships were quite low in the water. We had even a few Land Rovers, which weren't much use to us, it turned out, on board as well. And so we were fairly heavily loaded, low in the water, and the weather, although it was cold and clear and starlit to start with, and I very well remember seeing HMS Trepid once we got away from her, so sharply outlined against the moon. The weather very quickly changed and the wind got up, and eventually, I don't know quite why this was, but we got lost. We didn't quite know where we were. The weather turned nasty, the wind, as I say, got up, and waves began to break over the boat, and it was an open boat, there was not even canvas protection, and everyone got absolutely thoroughly soaked with seawater, and it went on and on. The wave broke, the spray covered everyone. Everyone was packed tight. You couldn't move, you couldn't stretch a leg. Circulation was absolutely at a standstill. And this seemed to go on for an eternity, is the best way to describe it. I never thought it would ever end. I thought the only end of this night's work would be a cold and quick death. I couldn't honestly see that we were going to successfully get to the end of this journey. Although I didn't entirely lose hope, I felt it was a pretty bad situation to be in. And one felt even more was this true when the skies were illuminated with star shell and rounds began to fall on the water. We were actually being fired at. We thought by shore batteries at this stage in our ignorance. And people near me said, oh, I think we're being mortared from the shore by heavy mortars. In fact, we were being fired on by our own ships. Fortunately, they recognised us in time and stopped firing. But we were a bit critical, to say the least, between about amphibious operations, which included arranging for our own ships to fire on us when we in fact turned up in their area of operations as a surprise rather than being expected. So we felt fairly poorly about this. But fortunately nobody was hurt as a result of this, but it certainly increased the apprehension factor, to say the least. This wasn't the end of it, because this, I think, happened, this shelling happened after we'd been going for a couple of hours, and there was still quite a long way to go, and there was always a chance that similar shelling would start, if not from our own side, from the enemies. And there seemed no end to this journey, and we got colder and wetter, and eventually dawn began to come, when we should have been landed by this time. And so, you know, as the light began to appear in the sky, and we began to feel even more vulnerable from possible enemy attack, because we were in an area where the enemy was known to be. But I believe it was thanks to the cool-headedness of one of our own company commanders, Major John Kisley, who subsequently won the Military Cross at Tumbledown Mountain. He is a small boat man, and he went up to assist on the bridge, and to who we have to thank entirely for this, I don't know, but he, along with the crew of the landing craft, managed to get it together and work out where we were, and decisions were taken. And instead of landing short of our objective, as was projected, we actually got to Bluff Cove Beach safe and unharmed. Now, we were cold, and indeed, on my own landing craft, there were three cases of exposure. These were men who simply could not move when we got there, because they were verging on the unconscious due to cold and wet. And the situation was saved by my regimental aid post staff getting them down into the cramped but very hot, oily engine room of the landing craft. There's a very small space where you can get two or three people on canvas bunks down near the engine room. We were able to get them in there, and they were left to dry out for the rest of the night, because the landing craft were going to stay at Bluff Cove Beach as dawn was approaching and move off back to wherever they were due to go next when darkness next came, because it wasn't safe for them to move from there. So those three exposure casualties were able to revive themselves in the heat of the engine room, and they later joined us, all of them.
Now, this was sometime before the tragedy at Fitzroy, when the Sagada had
was. Yes, it was. In fact, I think those landing craft that we used were later to be used unloading other ships in the Fitzroy Bluff Cove area. And some of them may well you attacked or took part in operations later in the war. We were lucky. All our four landing craft got to its objective, Bluff Cove Beach. We landed. And although the weather was very bad, we marched then with our equipment up to Bluff Cove settlement area and the hills surrounding, where battalion headquarters was set up in the barns there, and the men dug in trenches on the hills surrounding Bluff Cove settlement. When we walked up the hill from the beach to the settlement, which was a walk of about 1.5-2 km, it was into the teeth of a gale, sending sheets of hail in a horizontal fashion into our faces. And it did mean, in fact, when we got to Bluff Cove, that the battalion was in a pretty tired state. And although they were willing to go on, because we began at that stage to get a series of exposure casualties, men were going down. That following my representations to the commander, decision was made to rotate one company at a time from being positions on the hills protecting Bluff Cove settlement at the time into at least windproof accommodation in sheep shearing sheds which were associated with Bluff Cove settlement, so that they were able to get out of the wind and get dried out a bit. And this is the policy we pursued at the time, instead of pushing on from Bluff Cove Beach straight further towards Stanley. I think probably if we'd done that, walking further on in the teeth of what was, after all, a wet gale, it can't be described as anything else, with ice particles, I think we would have taken even more casualties than we did. As it was, we had 10 people who were 10 or was it a dozen people became, I think it was about a dozen altogether, people became serious exposure casualties. In other words, they were incapable of going on and they were verging on the unconscious. Other people were affected by the cold, but not as badly. And these had to be revived in the barns and settlement buildings that we had there. And I'd like to say here, because I don't think it appears anywhere else in the official record, and not from want of my trying to achieve this, I might add, but I think my efforts were blocked, is the only word for it, of trying to get recognition from the enormous amount of help we got, not only in dealing with our exposure casualties, but any other part of our life during our stay in the Bluff Cove area, from the settlement people. In particular, Mr. and Mrs. Kilmartin, who I got to know very well in one of the houses at the settlement, did everything another human being could to help sustain, first of all, our casualties and our sick and our men in general when we were in this area. Their efforts were heartening and warming. It gave everyone who came in contact with this couple absolute will to carry on, knowing that we were dealing with, and these were the first Falkland Islanders we'd come across, don't forget, knowing that we were dealing with people that really were British and that through no fault of their own were under, at that stage, or had been under foreign government. And we really did feel that we were fighting to protect the civil liberties of people which were, as far as we could see, as British as we were, and proved it by the sustaining things that they did for our battalion. They were really magnificent. Kevin and Diane Kilmartin, I shall always think of them with great affection, and only wish they could have got more recognition for the efforts that they